You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Morning, guys. Russ here, and I've got some exciting news for you all. Support from All Over Podcast is brought to you by Manscaped, the best in below-the-waist grooming. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. Manscaped is trusted by over 2 million men worldwide. Join the movement for all your below-the-waist grooming needs. Get 20% off and free delivery with the code MALLOVER20 at manscaped.com. Manscaped has just launched in the UK, and men have gone for years and years and years without having the right tools for the job. You can be one of the first men in the UK to experience their life-changing products. I know over the years I've struggled many times with personal grooming, shaving, creams, cutting yourself, all that sort of stuff. But none of that is a problem with the Manscaped redesigned electric trimmer. It features a cutting ceramic edge blade to reduce grooming accidents, 7,000 RPM motor, which enables it to work seamlessly through even the thickest of hair. So, go get rid of that bush, make it clean and tidy, and get 20% off and free delivery with the code MALLOVER20 at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free delivery with MALLOVER20 at manscaped.com. Your balls will definitely thank you. Now it's time for Brian Habana.
Hi there, I'm Brian Habana, and you're listening to the Mall Over Codpost.
Hello, everyone. A little bit different, as you've probably already worked out. Mall Over Podcast with just Ben and Phil, giving you the news, views, and opinion from across the West Country. Mostly views at the moment, isn't it? We don't get a lot of news.
There's plenty of opinions. We've always got opinions to give.
Old man, or the old man laughs at, shouts at cloud podcast, as we may soon be called. So yeah, Russ is unavailable at short notice. I think he's doing some cricket coaching.
I thought he was on the beers celebrating Mourinho getting the sack.
Well, that'll give him the chance to celebrate Spurs coming sixth out of sixth thing. English clubs in the new much anticipated Super League.
Yep. No, I hope he is doing some cricket coaching, because at least it'll be something useful for him to do.
Well, better than setting himself on fire just for attention. I don't know where Doug is. Do we know where Doug is?
I think is there some darts on or some snooker or something, some kind of dull sport thing that he's working all week anyway.
Again, he's doing something useful while the two of us are sat here, I think, is probably the answer to that question. So I guess it's a rugby podcast. Should we talk about some rugby?
I think we better do.
Okay, well, we'll quickly go through the scores. Northampton beat London Irish 44-26. I heard this was a good game, but I'm afraid I didn't see it, and I don't think you did either, Phil.
No, There might not be that much in the way of proper rugby punditry tonight, because I haven't watched much rugby and I don't think you have either. But Northampton are doing pretty well at the moment, though. And Irish are kind of sticking a bit true to form, whether it's win one, lose one a bit.
Yeah, I think this season teams seem to be winning in clusters, which probably says more about the stop-start nature of this season than anything else. I know, you know, Bath, you would say, are having a bad season, but suddenly they're on a run of wins and might almost get back into it. We'll probably come to them later. So, Phil, you did see the Exeter game. They pretty easily beat Wasps, to be quite honest.
Yeah, and actually, 20 minutes in, Exeter were 10-0 up, and it fairly flattered them, to be honest, because Wasps were absolutely all over Exeter. They were running some really nice patterns. Everything was clicking. I mean, if that team were to lose Fekitoa, they would be half the team that they are. The guy absolutely runs the show in midfield. He's super aggressive in defence, getting right up in Exeter's face. The Wasps' line speed was fantastic. Exeter barely had the ball as a result. They got turned over a couple of times as well. And Wasps, as I say, they were running some decent patterns and shifting the ball wider relatively early, getting a bit of joy. But it was just two little bits of little mistakes that let Exeter in. So there was Wasps had a line out on the 5 meter line, attacking line out, got stopped short. Really good bit of counter driving by Exeter, and just as Robson was about to ship the ball out, as soon as he took a step away from that ruck, Alec Hepburn broke his bind and just got. I don't even think he got contact on him before the ball was passed, but got his long arms waving in Dan Robson's face. And Robson passed the ball straight to Henry Slade, jogging up in the defensive line.
I mean, never a good idea, you've got to say.
No, quick inside pop to Devoto, and Devoto runs 80 yards to score a try. Lovely bit of a blocking line from Facundo Cordero, just running on Devoto's inside shoulder whilst, I can't remember who it was, I think it was Rob Miller, was coming across to try and make the tackle. And every time Miller went a little bit quicker to get in front of him, Cordero went a little bit quicker. Miller slowed down to try and wrap behind him. Cordero slowed down. And then from about 15 yards away, according to the referee, Cordero made an inside run to take a pass, otherwise known as a complete blocking line in front of Miller, and just let Devoto step in. And then about 5 minutes later, turnover ball. There was a bit of a nothing ruck in the middle that Wasps didn't commit to, somewhere around the 10-metre line. Cameron Dickey just picked it up and went, ran over the top of Umanga, who looked like he was a tackling bag, like just fell flat on his arse.
Umanga's defence is a real concern, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And then couple of bits of quick hands ends up in the hands of that well-known winger, Johnny Hill, who strolls over like a slightly discoordinated giraffe. But then come half time, it was 13-10 and Wasps, and it was a score that didn't flatter Wasps in any way, shape or form. But the second half from Exeter was just a different ball game. I mean, they just have too many players where if one or two of them click and have a proper game, most teams are going to struggle, and it was Stuart Hogg as much as anybody else on Saturday. But I mean, yeah, I worry a bit about Wasps, particularly if there's a little bit of a rumour going around that Fekitoa may well go for some big money over the channel. For the squad that they've got, they're seriously underperforming.
Well, they're not going down, are they?
No, I mean, true.
I mean, in a real sort of divergence for this podcast, should we talk about Exeter?
Yeah, well, we can do, yeah.
I think what you just said is a real feature of Exeter at the moment. They regroup at half time, and I think you can tell sometimes from if there's a pre-half time interview with Rob Baxter, he knows exactly what's going on, and they have gone away from teams a lot of times in the second half this year. But also, I mean, they've now gone out of Europe, and I think they've lost more games this year than probably they would have done in previous years. Is that because they're just not playing as well, or are they keeping their powder dry? What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think they're just not clicking. They're a long way off 100%, and it's almost a case of if they didn't have so many big game players who can pull something out of the bag, they would be kind of somewhere around that fourth position in the table. But as it is, they've just got enough players who can turn it around. I mean, the results, apart from that European game that they won against Lyon quite convincingly, they looked pretty fortunate to be in touch at halftime on Saturday. They obviously got well beaten by Leinster. They got reasonably well beaten by Gloucester, although you wouldn't say it was Exeter's first team. Again, they flattered to deceive against Leicester. They beat Quins by a point. And so you're going back, you're a run of four or five games there where they're not firing. And Baxter's kind of alluded to it in some of his pre-halftime talks that there's something there that just isn't quite clicking. And I think it's probably a bit of a come down from winning, doing the double last season in a really strange season that finished very late, then almost going straight into this season, having the Six Nations. Does it happen? Doesn't it happen? What's happening with all of our squad players? And I just think, I think it's a factor of all of those things, but they're not clicking.
And they're great rivals, aren't there? Are they? It must be a bit of a sort of come down. You know, it's a bit like Celtic winning the league when Rangers weren't there. They don't have Saracens to sort of play off and maybe build to games against them. And you know, they're probably favourites in every game they go into nowadays. And that must make life difficult.
I just think, it definitely does make things difficult. And I don't think they've significantly changed their game plan from what it was previously. And I don't think people will say, they've been worked out. I don't think it's that at all, because the way they were playing last season, even if you worked them out, you couldn't do anything about it. Yeah. And the problem is, last season, they get the ball within 10 metres of the try line. It's a try every time. And now you just see too many little knock-ons, or they just don't quite get the grouping right on the mauls or whatever, but something just goes wrong and they give away a penalty or they give away a knock on or they get turned over. And that wasn't happening last season. It's just a lack of clinicalness.
So maybe one last question with Exeter, and then we'll move on and keep Matt and James, at least Saracens contingent, entertained. Last week we were really concentrating on favourite dictators and animals we punched in the head. So we didn't talk about the Exeter-Leinster game. I didn't see that one. And I wondered, how did Simmons get on against the Leinster back row?
He was quiet. He was definitely quiet. And I think it was probably a fair reflection of what we've seen of Simmons at international level, that he doesn't quite flourish in the same way that he does when he's playing for Exeter. That's not to say that he plays badly. It's not to say that he's shown up as being a bad player. You just don't quite achieve as much when you've got, I mean, just looking at the Leinster team in front of me, they've effectively got 15 internationals there. And that makes it very difficult. Whereas when you're playing a club side, there's always a slightly weaker shoulder or a weaker link that you can run at, or you're kind of making an extra 2 or 3 yards after contact and bustling forwards. And it was, I suppose it was a bit like you stick an informed Billy against an informed, against the South African back row, and he makes very little yardage. You stick him against Italy and he looks like an absolute worldie. And it was a bit like that. It's not to say that he did anything wrong. It was just a lot harder for him than say playing against Worcester.
Yeah, I think that was kind of what I expected you to say, having seen when he played for England against Ireland, and And it was the same. It wasn't that he was doing anything badly. It was just he wasn't able to do what he does well as well. So, yeah, probably our last serious point of the whole podcast is that...
There are some players, like I think Vermeulen and probably to some extent Dave Ewers. I think if you play them against anybody, and they'll pretty much do the same job and they'll look exactly the same.
Yeah.
But Simmons's game kind of suits having a few weak shoulders there, a few kind of lazy runners, bit more disorganized in defense. Just things not quite being 100% right. And in the same way that kind of Johnny May absolutely flourishes against weaker back lines and doesn't look quite so good against stronger ones. I just think for some people, they can maintain a standard because that standard isn't based around what the opposition does. It's based around what they do. And for someone like Sam Simmons, it is very much about that, how he relates to the opposition.
Yeah, and I guess the better the back row he's playing, the more defending he's doing as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So, same day, we've got Sale just squeaking past Gloucester. Harlequins absolutely walloping Worcester. Doug was of the opinion that Worcester are now worse than London Welsh were, which I guess is the result of them not having to worry about relegation. And a good away win for Bristol at Newcastle. Yesterday, there was a decent game at the Rec, Bath against Leicester, which I did actually manage to watch yesterday. I think the first thing to take away from this game is that young Stewart at fullback for Leicester is super. You know, he's the definition of dominating under a high ball. He just came for everything, and I think he caught everything that came his way. Bath played very well the first half without actually taking very much advantage of it. So they were behind 9-7 at half time, and then decided that they were going to lose the game in the second half, just gave away silly penalties, threw away chances, and Ford was playing well and kicking the corners and just slotting over penalties when he got the chance. And Bath kind of shot themselves in the foot until the last 10 minutes. When Leicester decided they could do one better and gave away roughly a penalty every 30 seconds, it felt like.
So on the Stewart point, is he the next kind of the next in line for England fullback now?
Well, you'd hope so. I mean, he's a big lad. He seems to have a decent boot on him as well, but. You know, under the high ball, it was really impressive. I mean, you had Watson playing at fullback for Bath, and he's not as solid under the high ball. But once he gets the ball, you know, the opposition is in trouble. And Young's kicked very much like Young's often does, and just overkicked his box kicks a little bit. And you know,
made Watson's job's easy.
Yeah,
easy.
I mean, Watson picked one up in his own 22, and he just shaped a kick, and then he saw it was Genge coming at him, and he just ran round him.
Yeah, I have always thought with Watson that I know you're a big fan of Watson at fullback, and I would probably have Watson starting at fullback for England. I do wonder whether kind of picking Watson at fullback because he's a good back three player and he needs to get in the team. And of the, like, you wouldn't stick Johnny May at fullback, and
no.
Elliot Daly's shown himself to be a bit of a liability. And unless you're going to go back to Mike Brown, which Eddie Jones isn't going to do, Watson's probably the best of the people that's available there. But it does seem very much that, like, Stewart's got an opportunity, maybe not for the next World Cup, maybe it's a bit early, but certainly after that, to make Anthony Watson get seen as a wing again.
Well, I think, yeah, I fully agree. I think if you asked me today who I would pick out of the two at fullback, I'd pick Stewart. And I'd have Watson on the wing because he's fantastic on the wing. But... you know, he was great. And actually, I've been really impressed with De Glanville playing at fullback for Bath as well, who's injured at the moment. So in this game, you know, Bath scored a try in not quite red time, but with about 30 seconds to go. And you had to be impressed with Spencer, who threw a long miss pass for Muir to dot down in the corner, which gave him a incredibly difficult conversion to win the game. which he slotted. So fair play to Spencer for backing himself. You know, Bath had the Faletau, Underhill, Mercer back row, which, you know, we've been waiting to see for a long time. They all played okay, with the exception of Mercer, who was really, really good. But, you know, it was two teams that both did their best to lose the game.
So, I haven't seen the incident, but there's been a lot of chat about a penalty given away by Visa after Mercer giving a bit of afters, and then him giving a bit of after afters.
Yeah,
getting penalised for the after afters. Yeah, what's your take on that?
I think they were all being a bit daft, really. I mean, Hayes gave Mercer a shove, so Mercer sort of chased him a little bit, and then it was broken up, and Mercer was walking away, and Visa gave him a shove. So, you know, I think really Visa doesn't need to do it.
Not a penalty at Cornwall Devon level. Is that what you're saying?
No. Well, depends on the referee, doesn't it? But
yeah,
handbags, very much handbags. I don't think Wade Dooley would have been impressed, put it that way.
No.
In terms of rugby, really, that's all we've got in terms of what's happened this weekend.
Before we move off Bath, bearing in mind that it's just you and one other here, so here's your opportunity to rave about Bath. how important is, well, for a start, they're looking like they might have a chance of squeezing into the playoffs, which, given that it's a bit of a nonsense season, would still be seen as a bit of a success for them. But how important is Ben Spencer to how they're playing at the moment? What happens post Spencer? Is Spencer staying? Is he going back to Saracens?
I'm not entirely sure. Was he a transfer or was he a loanee? I think he was a transfer, wasn't he?
I thought he was a loanee, but I can dig into that while you tell me about how important you think he is to how they're playing.
I mean, I think he's incredibly important because...
Yeah, you're right. They did sign him on a 3-year deal. So
yeah,
I apologise for that.
I think that Leicester were doing quite a good job of keeping him on the floor in this game because Mercer seemed to be at scrum half almost as much as Spencer was. And I think that a scrum half being sort of not targeted, I don't think that's a fair phrase, but as a focus for the defence is a compliment to him. But he's a threat. He's a threat with his running because he will, you know, have a dart around the base. He's got decent service. It's probably not the best, but it's certainly not the worst. And of course, his box kicking is absolutely spot on. I mentioned Youngs was hitting them too young, too long. that's quite an allegation.
It is.
Other than one, he completely shanked. Spencer was every single one was spot on, which almost made what Stewart was doing more impressive. And you know what that means is, if it's not competed for, whoever's catching it is getting Sam Underhill in their face as soon as they catch it. So I think Spence is incredibly important. I believe they've let Chudley go. And I think that having him in there has helped Bath a lot in the last two games, especially because they've lost their fly half in the first 20 minutes for the last two games. And they've already got a youngster or a sort of part-timer in there, or, you know, at the start of the game at the moment because the two starters are injured. So having... I think, would you say Spence is the closest we've got to a French-style nine?
Yeah. He's kind of got that Morgan Parra-like abrasiveness without being so French about the whole thing.
Yes.
He's, in some ways, he reminds me a bit of Mike Phillips. But I think that's just because he's a bit taller than most scrum halves.
Yeah, I think so.
And I do wonder whether... You need a back row who can quite happily step in there because he will get involved a bit more than other scrum halves.
Yeah, absolutely.
You rarely see Dan Robson clearing people out of a ruck, but if Spencer has to, he'll go and do it without thinking too much about it. But he's, I don't know, I really rate him. And I think obviously he was pretty instrumental in kind of the long-term success of Saracens as part of that squad. And I suppose the concern was going to be, how does that transfer to another team? And I think he's done a pretty good job, to be honest, so far. And I agree, I think he is pretty important, to particularly with the issues they're having at 10. I mean, if you look at 12, 13, 14, 15 that started on Saturday, you've got Redpath, Joseph, Kokonasinghe and Watson. You've just got to get the ball out there to them and let them do what they do as much as possible, which means that you need a nine who can distribute really well, but also keep those fringe players honest. And I think that's what he does a good job of. I mean, Ben Youngs used to do a really good job of making sure that those guards don't move, because they have to keep an eye on him, and he's stopped doing it quite so much now. But I think Spencer's big enough and makes enough of those darts that he keeps those guards honest whilst distributing really well.
Yeah, I think Youngs has really dropped off on that. And I think you're absolutely right in that Spencer is the best at that of the English scrum halves. And also he's got the support lines nailed down. Robson, of course, is good at that as well, but he runs that sort of DuPont, Aaron Smith kind of line really well. So after what sounded worryingly like
a rugby podcast,
rugby analyst analysis for 24 minutes, should we go to some Ask Mo?
Yeah, let's do that.
We've got some again from our good friend Salty Nors with two Z's. His Twitter handle is I'm just not going to try it. You've all heard my pronunciations. So following Phil's sort of humble brag about decking a lion last week, he asks, what is the biggest, most scary animal you'd be willing to have a fist fight with?
I think there's a big difference between what would be the biggest and what would be the scariest.
Yeah.
Because there are some quite big, quite stupid animals. God, that's a really challenging one, because I would rather under-egg my abilities and make sure I win. I'd rather go for like a giant lop rabbit than go for anything too big and scary.
I've seen Watership Down way too many times to be fighting a giant lop rabbit. I think with
I've
all
seen Monty Python and the Search for the Holy Grail.
Yeah, I think we should probably warn the audience now that with just the two of us on here, there's probably going to be significantly less comedy and entertainment and significantly more farm animal chat. So so if that's not your bag, maybe just come back next week. But
I'd definitely take on a slightly narked alpaca, just because I really don't like them.
They're quite related to llamas, aren't they? So
yeah, but bit softer.
Yeah, I mean, no one's going to fight a llama. Very good guard dogs, llamas, despite not being dogs.
So, yeah, also apparently alpacas are very good at keeping foxes away.
Yes, yeah.
We've moved into a nature podcast now.
Yes, so any sort of, any rise on an alpaca, or is that your limit?
No, I'm going to stick with an alpaca, either that or a lame donkey on a beach.
I mean, I'm thinking an alpaca with its sort of head on a long neck would be quite a good sort of, like a punch bag.
Yeah. They swing back towards you. You've got to duck and bob a bit.
I mean, I think you're right. I don't think you want to be going much larger than that, do you? Because, you know, I mean, animals are just scary, a lot of them.
Yeah.
I was thinking maybe a sheep would be my limit.
Yeah. Oh, Christ. Yeah, it depends on the sheep.
But exactly. I started thinking like a Texel ram would probably just steamroll me. Yeah.
They barrel you over and then trample all over you when you're on the floor. I reckon I could take on a bear.
A bear. Koala. Yeah, koala bear. Yeah.
Not going any bigger than that.
No. Yeah, it's a difficult one. I think, you know, either a sort of bog standard sheep would be my upper limit. But again, some of the muscle men would probably get the best of me. So we're talking the kind of animal you could use as a footrest, really, is probably the limit we've got there. I've noticed...
You and Duke.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't want to fight Duke, I've got to say. He's quite built, so...
You'd probably also end up fighting...
Sarah, yeah. There's only one there, yeah. So there we go. There's some red-hot animal chat. He also says your bedside manner with the cows must be outstanding. Once they're playing up, you just whisper in their ear, "I knocked a lion out once," and then they chill out.
Yeah, they just stand there quietly and take what they've got coming.
So yeah, there we go. There's the banter section of the podcast. So, Phil, you have some issues, and I'll just leave that there, arising from the soccer ball news of yesterday.
Yeah, well, I just thought we could... that it's very relatable to some of the conversations that are going on in rugby at the moment. So for those of you that avoid football like the plague, like we all should, there's this announcement of a breakaway league. Top, let's say, there are 12 clubs from England, Spain and Italy talking about setting up their own breakaway competition against the Champions League, effectively, saying that fans want to see quality matches against quality opposition every week. But let's not kid ourselves. This is all about money and this is about ring fencing. So this is about the top clubs securing their ability to get as much money out of it as possible. And let's just take, for example, one of those clubs, Man United, aren't even in the Champions League because they didn't do well enough last season. Let's have a look at another one. Arsenal, not in the Champions League, but not only that, they're currently ninth in the table and they managed a highly successful draw against Fulham yesterday. And Spurs, considering themselves one of the big six in England, is like a banana man considering himself one of the Marvel
big six in the Avengers.
Exactly. So but yeah, it's about money and it's about ring fencing. And in that regard, it's very similar to the conversations that are going on about ring fencing the Premiership. It's also very similar to some of the conversations that have happened historically around the European competition in rugby. And I just think this trend towards, I mean, in cricket, you've now got franchises in the 100. This trend towards financial institutions rather than clubs, and those institutions being set at the top tier ad infinitum, just ruins everything that I like about sport. I love the fact that Bristol, whenever it was, three or four seasons ago, were in the Championship. I love the fact that Exeter Chiefs were in the had only just made it to the top tier for the first time 10 years ago and are now considered a mainstay at the top. I love the fact that you've got Leicester Tigers, who for all of my time growing up were one of the top two with Bath, have had times when they've looked like they're going to get relegated and drop out of the top division. That to me is what sport is about. It's about having winners and having losers. It's not about, and we've seen what's happened to the Premiership this season with no relegation. Worcester are fielding a team of people who literally couldn't give a shit. Gloucester have done their very best to try and get fewer points than Worcester. Newcastle hit the guns running and since then have kind of given up the ghost a little bit. And basically everyone now, let's squeeze Leicester in for argument's sake. Everyone now below Leicester, so the bottom five teams out of 12, have literally nothing to play for.
Yeah.
Leicester, Bath and Irish could maybe if all of the things collide in the right way, squeeze into the top four, but give it another game and for a couple of those that would probably be out of the equation. And then you're down to five teams fighting for the top four and everybody else just totally dialing it in. Now you have a season where there's no relegation from the very start. What happens? So that what they're talking about is two divisions of 10 teams, and the top three automatically go through to a quarterfinals, and fourth, fifth have a playoff. Say you lose your first three games, you're out of it. You've got bugger all chance of getting through to that knockout stage. So you then spend the rest of the season just totally dialing it in and trying to bring your money in. And it's just an absolute farce. So, and I know there's people, there's let's call them rugby fans, and I'm doing inverted commas when I say the word fans, who think that ring fencing would be a good idea because it's always the same 12 to 14 teams there or thereabouts who are in the Premiership and nobody else is really breaking in and staying in. Well, that may be the case, but as I say, Bristol have been up and down multiple times and now at the top. Exeter are up towards the top. Worcester 4 or 5 years ago were in, I think they were in National 2, something like that, in the equivalent of the fourth division. Now, if you lose that ability for a team to drive up through, you're taking away a lot of those aspirations. I heard a Blackburn fan talking about it and saying that he supported Blackburn from winning the Premier League to being in League One. But that carrot of potentially getting back up to the top again is what kind of swings a lot of fans towards coming to watch their team week in, week out. And you take that away and it's all gone. Now, let's say in the Premiership they ring fence with 12, the 12 that are there plus Saracens and Ealing, which I think is what's the hope. Now, Doncaster have been around getting in for so flipping long. That would just be massively harsh on them. Pirates have been pumping there or thereabouts for a while. But you've got other teams that 20 years ago were mainstays of the top divisions. Your Richmonds, even when you go into the National League, there are teams, your Rotherhams and the like, that have been up at the top that have now massively dropped down. It's got to work both ways. There's other teams that have got the opportunity to go up. Leeds, bottom of National League One now. But, yeah.
I think these people are like kids at Christmas. You know, when you're a kid, you're like, oh, I wish it was Christmas Day every day because Christmas Day is brilliant. And actually, when you get a bit older, you realise Christmas Day is brilliant because it doesn't happen every day. And that's what sport's like. That's why England against the All Blacks used to be a real event because it happened infrequently. And it's why the Lions is still an event because if they picked a Lions squad once every 3 months, we wouldn't be as interested in doing all these different picks and stuff. And so...
And I don't think it would mean as much for the players either.
No, and it's just people trying to milk a sort of cash cow until it goes dry. And it's just not... It's not, but I don't think sport is run for fans anymore.
No, it's not.
Because, I mean, it easily in 10 years, there could be nothing for us to watch because rugby could be unrecognisable because of the concussion issue. It doesn't matter what you think of the decisions and the rules that are made. If you don't like them or you like them, there's the possibility there that the sport's going to be unrecognisable in 10 or 15 years. Football, if this goes through, could be something completely different. And 2020 could just eat cricket alive. It could be all there is. So, you know, and it's all to do with money. It's all to do with getting more games.
And interestingly, let's ignore the 100. I'm probably more interested now in the county championship than I have been for years. And obviously cricket's been relatively ring-fenced for decades. I can't remember the last team that's kind of come up from minor counties to the county championship.
Yeah, well, nothing but since Durham, is it?
No. Well, and I don't know when that was, but they've taken a format that became a bit dry, became a bit samey-samey, because you've got eight of the same sides in Division 2 and six of the same sides in Division 1 and a few moving between them. And they've gone, right, let's mix it up and do something a little bit different and come up with this kind of three, I don't even know what they call them. They can't call them divisions, but three groups that play everybody. So all of a sudden you're playing different sides. You're playing sides that you haven't played for ages and there's a bit more interest around it. Now that may well be because Hampshire have absolutely dicked their two opposition in the first two games, which never happens. But yeah, I'm finding the county championship a bit more interesting. If they'd have gone the other way and say, right, we're going to ring fence with those six that are a ways up, and the rest of you guys can just play around and be feeder clubs, I think I wouldn't give a shit about the county championship.
Yeah. I just think, money's talking, and it's always going to, but it's just a shame. I've said 1,000 times on this podcast, the European Cup would be a far better tournament in rugby if it was just 8 teams and they started at the quarterfinals, or even if they just made it straight knockout from the start.
So I kind of agree. So a large part of me kind of agrees with your 8-team approach, because it should be about the champions. In fact, sod 8 teams, let's go with 4, because it should be about your champions. But actually, I've got nothing against extended tournaments. You just make them straight knockouts. Let's get 32 teams in, straight knockout from the start, done. It's the magic of the FA Cup in another name. It's the old Pilkington Cup in rugby that everybody loved and was a massive thing for teams to win. And since it's gone, nothing's been able to replace it, because they piss about with these little tables and they can't look at a format and go, that's what fans like, because it limits your number of games. That's the issue.
They don't want fans. They're gambling on us still watching it. They want new people. And to get new people, they need tries, they need runs, they need goals, and they don't really care. And there's a good article. I didn't read the whole thing, but I saw some quotes from it by Jonathan Liu in the Guardian, because of course I'm a very left-leaning Guardian reader on this fascist podcast. But he's just saying, you know, although we don't want Real Madrid against Liverpool, the kid at home who's gonna bully his dad into buying a shirt for each does. He wants Real Madrid versus Liverpool every week.
And I tell you who else wants Real Madrid versus Liverpool every week.
Real Madrid and Liverpool.
Real Madrid, Liverpool, but it's China want it every week.
Absolutely.
And that's the point, is sport has become more about how many shirts and how many subscriptions can you sell in Southeast Asia, and not how many fans can you get in through the gate because you're playing the best sport.
Cricket is the same, but substitute China for India.
Yeah. Exactly.
Cricket aren't even interested in the Chinese market because of India. If you get the chance to watch Death of a Gentleman, do that. But if the
Indians got into football, then football would care about what India say as well. But yeah.
One last point before we move away from football on this rugby podcast is I haven't read enough about it, and I could just be being a cynic here, because as soon as I saw the news, I kind of just was sort of weary resignation. But do you think it might be a bargaining point? They've kind of gone in saying we're going to break away, but actually what they want is for the midweek Champions League to be a league format without anyone getting knocked out, so that they can all play each other. And do you think that might be how it ends?
I think it started very, very much as a bargaining tool in terms of we need more money out of it. So not even necessarily we want to play each other so that we play more high profile games. I think part of it is Man United don't want to go to Trabzonspor or some team in Azerbaijan or someone like that. And they would almost rather foreshorten the first table stage and have team skipping to the second table stage and then have more good matches. But also I think the point is that so much of the Champions League revenue gets skimmed by UEFA, and the clubs think that they should be getting more of it. So I think it definitely started as a bargaining tool. And I think UEFA just went, nah, fuck you. We're UEFA, we don't need you. And then they went, well, actually we're serious. And they went, okay, then go on then. But you won't be playing in your own leagues, and you won't be playing, none of your players will be playing for their countries. So yeah, crack on. I think it's turned into a bit of a, yeah, fuck you. No, fuck you. Yeah, fuck you kind of situation, where they're like, escalating to the point where nobody feels strong enough to back down.
But, yeah, so someone's going to knock their heads together.
The press release has come out very much like this is a done deal and nothing's going to change it.
So Phil, we've got some questions from Matt.
I know, I've just seen them.
I'm not touching one of those with a barge pole.
Is that the bottom one?
No, the middle one.
Well, yeah, you're right. Well, mainly because Matt's misspelt benefits, but he has,
hasn't he? Yeah, yeah. Phil, what would you name your boat if you had one?
So I think I would have a relatively small boat. I wouldn't go for anything too over the top, but I would give it a really ostentatious name, like the Golden Princess or I've Got More Money Than You on a little 10-foot fishing boat, just so the juxtaposition doesn't look quite right. What about yourself?
Well, it's a difficult one, isn't it?
You'd call it something in Cornish, probably.
Oh, what a good idea. Yeah, what's Cornish for boat? Nice boat.
Nice boat.
Let's look it up. Talk amongst yourselves. There's a chap that we know who used to be in the Royal Navy. And my dad told me this story, so how accurate it is, I don't know. But he was sailing in Sydney Harbour and the Australian Coast Guard came alongside and said, oh, just so you know, very strong tides in this harbour. Have you sailed it before? So he said, well, yeah, I have. And they were like, oh, yeah, what, a little dart dinghy? And he was like, no, the Ark Royal.
Oh. God, you gotta love embarrassing Aussies.
Yeah, so there is there's a boat story for you. I've never really thought of having a boat, Phil, I've got to say.
I'd quite like I quite like wakeboarding. So something you can get out and do a bit of that. I quite like diving. And I quite like just being out in the water. So I have thought about having a boat. It's on the wish list, but the wish list is really quite long and it's probably somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. I'm not a very good swimmer, so.
Yeah, it's probably not a good idea for you then. You're still looking up boat.
Yeah, I'm still looking up boat in Cornish and I'm not finding it. So let's abandon that idea. I would call it I don't know. Bill.
Bill, good work.
Yeah. Okay, we've got some rugby questions here from Ben Bacon. Why are refs so clueless about front row penalties?
Because most front row players are clueless about front row penalties.
That's very true.
So that's the flippant answer. The honest answer is because not many refs have played in the front row. So they don't entirely understand what's going on. But then the other side of it is that actually the laws are fairly clear and fairly black and white. But as with everything that's black and white, it's actually really quite hard to interpret the mentality behind what's happening. So, for example, it says you've got to drive straight. Now, if it happens to be not going straight, is that because somebody's consciously not driven straight? Is that because somebody on the defending team's taken a step backwards? You've got to support your own weight. Well, if it goes down, most of the time, both props go down at the same time. Now, I'm pretty sure Ben played loose head, so he will know more about it than I will. I have spent probably four seasons, not the hotel, in playing hooker, but in all honesty I didn't have a bloody clue what was happening either side of me. I just wanted to push as hard as I could, kick the ball, either hook it back on my side or boot it through the other side, and try to keep my spine in a straight line so that it didn't crumple and ruin me.
I mean, I think the answer is front row forwards tend to be bigger guys who get bigger as they retire, and they just can't be top level referees because of getting around the pitch. I think it would be it's probably a small niche of people that are front row experts, not injured enough that they can run around and with the motivation to want to be an international level referee. I think that's probably the answer to it, because no, as you say, no one knows what's going on up there, least of all a lot of the front row forwards. So I think that's the answer.
The first one I said about not driving straight, that's probably the easiest one to pick. You see a lot of free kicks given now for teams pushing early, but equally I think in my mind there should be more about teams not taking the hit, so being really passive in that engage. And when you've got two sets of eight people who are trying to engage at the same time, and it's supposed to stay over a central line, but they haven't pre-agreed how hard they're gonna take that initial contact, it becomes a bit of a minefield. And I almost think, actually, going back to the hit and get the ball in earlier, you'd end up with fewer penalties. The problem is, you also end up with people getting hurt, because if your angles aren't right, you go backwards or you go sideways or you go bent in a big V.
I think Russ might have actually had the answer to scrums, which is set a time limit on them getting ready. And just get them there and in, and it wouldn't solve every problem. But
I suppose the thing that I struggle with is at lower levels, and it's probably linear in that the lower down the levels you go, the more obvious it is. You get fewer scrum penalties, and the scrums are generally ball goes in one side, comes out at the number 8's feet, and gets gone. And at lower levels, there's a much higher disparity of skill and quality and strength between the front rows. But I think there's also an acceptance that the ref isn't going to ping somebody. They just want the ball out and gone because they don't understand what's going on. So it's almost a case of they've been over-refed, and the front rows are trying to be too clever. And if they just stuck to get down and push, there wouldn't be a need for any of the penalties.
So Ben also asks, what breed of dog would each of the England first 15 be? I'm sure going to get through them all, but
Johnny May would be a Springer Spaniel because he just runs around quickly with no real idea what he's doing. I think Tom Curry would be a Labrador because he's just... Oh, no, Tom Curry would be a Collie because he's just trying to keep going all the time, round things up, just interested in that ball. Just want to get the ball, where's the ball? Sam Underhill would be a Staffy because he's just nails.
No neck.
But no neck. I suppose probably a Bulldog more than a Staffy, but I think I've done enough there.
I had Johnny May as a sort of slightly discombobulated Collie, which actually might be my boat name. Let's go with that. But yeah, I definitely see the Springer. I see a little bit of Johnny May and Duke when he spots a seagull and takes off across the beach. Owen Farrell, maybe a slightly angry lurcher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A greyhound that's just been released from his track career.
Yeah.
Trying to find a home.
enough of this whimsy. Matt asks, never see Russ again or £50?
I'll be honest, this might shock a few people. I went on holiday with Russ to Portugal. I actually quite like him.
I'm going to shock you. I like Russ, despite what I said earlier.
He can be a bit of a prick sometimes, and he is... quite good for taking the mickey out of, but he's generally a nice guy.
Russ is a much better guy in person than in podcast world, and certainly than on Twitter. We went
he's,
up...
he's also a much nicer guy the fewer of you are about.
Yeah. which, considering we played rugby with him and that meant there were 30 people around, says something about him on the rugby pitch. Me and Russ, we travelled from Cornwall to Twickenham together a few times, and I've never had reason to not want to do it again. I'll take the £50 and I'll see Russ again. I think that was the options, wasn't it?
Take £50 or never see Russ again, or £50.
Yeah. So
yeah, well done.
Everyone's a winner. Yeah. This was annoying. Thanks to Frank Rigdon. What's a more annoying concept, the tight headlock or the spiral bomb?
Tight headlock.
If you watched the Bath game, if you had spiral bomb on the bingo chart, you were a winner. It must have been said about once every 3 minutes.
Now, I'm not... you can't really see what's happening with the ball many times on... No thanks to Dougie's camera work. Many times when it gets kicked high, because you're generally on a wider angle lens and the ball is a few pixels on your 14-inch screen. What is a spiral bomb? Is it just a spiral kick that goes high and not very... A spiral Gary Owen? Is that all it is?
I think so, yeah. It's kind of a torpedo that goes up. So it swings as it comes down, I think. Although one that they said was a spiral bomb was coming down end over end. So whether I've not got the concept...
So is it just horseshit from commentators?
I think there's a certain degree of that.
In which case, I'll go for the spiral bomb. I was going to go for the tight headlock.
It's far more annoying than the tight headlock, because I think the tight headlock is a thing, but it's a thing that know-it-alls like to talk about in rugby commentary.
It's a thing for people who don't know their left from their right.
I can't be bothered learning my left from my right, but I have learned tight head and the other one, loose head.
Okay, so here's torpedo punt is apparently an Aussie rules thing, which is also known as a screw punt or a
torpedo
punt.
Torpedo punt is a fantastic name for a boat.
I quite like screw punt. I think the principle is it goes longer and it moves it, so it goes higher.
It drops early. It's almost like a top spinner. It kind of comes. It doesn't follow the trajectory. Did you play for Hornets when we got that? After the Sevens tournament, they donated a load of balls, and they were like a Duke cricket ball after about 20 overs. They come down and then they about 10 feet off the ground, they just sort of swing to the left. They were a nightmare.
No and no. I've googled spiral bomb, and every single item on spiral bombs are behind paywalls. So the Times, the Telegraph, the Guardian, which and the rugby paper, which makes me think that it's just commentators being wankers.
Yeah. Well, Phil, we've reached nearly an hour with no more than one Partridge quote. So I think we've done pretty well there. I think Alan Partridge is coming back on the 30th of April, for those who haven't heard. So he has got a second series. Have you got any other business, mate?
Well, not really, but I did want to answer one of Matt's other questions, which was, would you live on Mars? And no, I wouldn't live on Mars, because I would miss the peanuts from Snickers. I think you've got to have a balance with your chocolate bars.
Yeah, you need a bit of nutrition, don't you?
Yeah, and randomly I like the odd Twix every now and then. So no, I couldn't live on Mars. But no, nothing in terms of any other business. I've literally spent the last 3 days chopping trees down and chainsawing them into movable sections, so my back is still vibrating and my arms are pretty sore, and that is my life at the moment.
Okay, so what I'll do as my any other business is, I think Russ wanted to mention the great Maulover fixture, which is in the early stages of development. So we kind of got talking about it at the end of last week's pod, and carried on after we stopped recording. because we are genuinely friends, despite what we said earlier. So we're thinking of the weekend. I think it's the 9th of October.
Yes.
Doug's available. He's coming to Cornwall and he wants to get a game of rugby in. And we thought, as four semi to fully retired rugby players, maybe a veterans game would be ideal. And we've spoken to a few people with a bit of influence over local clubs, and we think we can get a fixture. So it's kind of an open invitation, pending absolute confirmation of the fixture, to any listeners who want a game of rugby. We even got hopes of Eddie Stevens coming over from Albuquerque. So
what we're trying to do is put together a Maulover Invitational 15. And I presume this is the invitation
yes.
to anybody who listens to either play against one of the local sides or a Cornish Vets Barbarians team or something like that. Bit of old school second team standard rugby, preferably with a few beers afterwards and maybe a bottle of port at half time. Maybe a rugby match afterwards, and perhaps a bit of a live recording in the evening, and certainly a chance to enjoy the Cornish sights.
And that early in the autumn, we hopefully might have some nice weather. So make a weekend of it, and maybe bring the families.
Not both of them. Just bring one of them.
Yeah. Don't bring both your wives. We don't want an atmosphere.
Unless one of them can play hooker.
Unless one of them is a hooker. Who knows?
No, one of them can play hooker.
All
right. Let's just be clear about this.
So we have had other questions, most of them completely unrepeatable. So we are going to leave it there. Next week, I'm sure Russ will be back and lending some actual structure to the podcast rather than...
Dougie, the first one of those two options I would go for. For Doug's question. That's all I'm saying on it.
Does he mean a chicken or the other kind?
The other kind.
Okay, yeah, fair enough.
Preferably mine as well.
Yeah, well, the atmosphere has turned rather sour. Right, so I've got to do the traditional sign-off, haven't I? Thank you, Phil. Thank you for carrying me through the podcast. And go well.
Sports Social Podcast Network.